So without further ado, Rob, I
thank you so, so much. Good evening. Thank you. I see there's a gentleman just coming back. Do you want a copy of the book? Can I give that to you? What's your name?
Laser.
Laser, it's good to meet with you. Duffy, could you shut the door as well? Is that okay? Okie dokie. Good evening, everybody. I hope this is recording. It's wonderful to see you back. Thank you so, so much.
I'm coming back in.
Thank you. It's already gone. Thank you so much for inviting me back for a sixth term to carry on our learning of the Jewish philosophy course here, based upon the Sefer Derech Hashem, The Way of God by Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. I just for the tape, which I've just started now, I just want to say that this is Le'ilui Nishmas, in the memory of Michal Bas Shimon, who is Daniel Gordon's mother, who's recently passed away. May her soul have an aliyah. Okay, what I'm going to do now is basically ease you all in. There's a couple of new faces, and even though we're very thin, I had like 8 or 9 people say they couldn't come tonight. So usually there's at least 7, 8, 9 more people each session, so they're going to miss this out. But again, they can get the downloads, which are sent out to people's email addresses. What I'd like to do is ease us back in over some of the topics that we discussed previously. And the format of the shiur, for those people who are new tonight, is that we're literally working through page by page through this book. The reason that we're working through this book as opposed to anything else is discussed in the very first session of the very first term, which is available on a download. I got a whole discussion as to why we're going to be using this book. Bottom line is there's nothing like it written in Jewish philosophy at all that's as condensed and concise and covers absolutely every single base of Jewish philosophy. So it's the quintessential book. What I can't do, though, is keep going over previous material over and over again, because just as you can imagine, let's say you've been here for like a term, and then someone else comes and they go, right, let's go back a whole thing. I've done that, and I want to go forward, and I want to do other things like that. So because I can't go back, what I'm going to do is try to recap a little bit. I know it's pretty like daunting, like jumping in, but don't worry, anywhere you jump in, I'm sure you'll be able to get something out of it. And again, there are downloads for absolutely everything. You can catch up at your own pace as you wish. Good evening. Has everyone got books and everything? Everyone comfortable? Everyone okay? Okay. So what I'm going to do tonight is just a teeny weeny bit of a recap of what we did 2 weeks ago, which is when we adjourned at the end of term 5 before the beginning of term 6, which may be useful for a couple of people maybe who weren't here at the end of term 5. Okay? All right. So we did a lot. We did the hardest bit in term 5. Term 5 was the biggest bump, as it were. Is everyone comfortable? Coffee? Does everyone want coffee? Anyone? Now's probably a good time to get coffee or tea if you want outside of...
Something good. Else that I realised I forgot. Very, very, very important.
Everything all right? Okay, we'll just let... I don't know what that was, but Dovey has found something extremely important to do. And, oh, I think he's going to get Pavlov the dog. I bet he's going to get a dog. Okay, maybe he will, maybe he won't, I don't know. So, for people that know who Pavlov the dog is, you'll meet him soon. He's going to get... Is it Pavlov? Were you looking for Pavlov? Okay, who's Pavlov the dog? Pavlov the dog is a dog that rings this bell. For people who are new to the group, let's just talk about this bell. Basically, a lot of lectures that you get, people don't ask questions as you go. The guy stands at the front and goes rah, 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 like that for about an hour or two. And then you, if you like, can ask questions at the end. That's not how it works here. It's totally interactive. It's totally dynamic. If you've got a question, put your hand up. If I can answer your question, I can answer your question. If I can't, I can't. It's pretty simple, right? Those are the rules of play. Everyone comfortable with that? Now, however, I have a special rule. And the rule is cot, completely off topic. So if we're talking about, I don't know, angels or something... But my dog's favourite food is horse meat, and I don't like horses in my horse meat. And I can say, that's a wonderful question, but it's completely off topic, because we're going to get too pulled in. I'd love to talk about horse meat scandals and kashrus and things like that, and dog food. It's great. Lots to talk about, but it's not on topic. So if you want to ask a question, bavakasha, but I reserve the right to be able to cry completely, good evening. Reserve the right to cry cot, completely off topic, okay? That's for the new people in the room who are thinking, goodness, what's Pavlov, what's the dog, what's the bell? Now you're all up to speed, that's the bell. It gets rung if I don't want to answer the thing. And it sometimes gets rung just because I like banging it. It's just loads of fun. Okay, oh yes, that's right. I was going to start with a recap. Do you need a book, do you need a pen? You're comfortable with everything. I'm going to start with a recap of what we did very, very quickly. Then we're going to run in on the page. And we're going to just carry on basically where we left off. And those of you will just kind of like, just kind of get it. You know what I mean? You guys will get it. Maybe, we'll see how it goes. Okay. Is everyone sitting comfortably? Then we'll begin. I'm going to do a little bit of a recap over a thing which we did almost at the beginning of Term 5, which you probably know very, very well if you were here at the beginning of Term 5. If you weren't, this is going to be new area, but I can't take too long over it. So let's call it a 5-10 minute recap before we jump in. Is that fair? Okay. We had an analogy. Okay, I work a lot with analogies. We had an analogy of a football match. And we talked about people in the arena, stadium, grounds of the football match. What's the correct word? It's a football stadium. Football stadium, right? I've got the right word. Football stadium. And there's, I don't know, let's say 100,000 people there. And we talked about the fact that some people are more important than others in that football stadium. We talked about Jeff at the back, who has a very large plastic cup of warm lager, and he sings vulgar songs. And he sometimes goes out to play on his iPhone and smoke cigarettes. Jeff is one of the members of the people in the football stadium. And we said that Jeff, overall, is not as significant, not as important, is not as kingpin, is not as absolutely vital to the whole football thing as possibly the captain of the football team, or the referee, or the goalies, or the players, the 22 men in shorts that kick a leather sack across a pitch into a net. Those guys are the most important people in the room. Does anyone here remember discussing this? Yes, yeah, we remember discussing it. There we go, because nobody made a noise, so I'd better make a rumbling noise just so for the tape, people are listening and they know that something's happening. Okay, obviously you don't make a noise. Now you just sit there and just let me do it. Okay, Okay, now, we said that, what's his name, Jeff, right? And Jeff goes, rah, rah, and he's singing vulgar songs, and as he sings, he waves his large, he can afford to wave the very large plastic cup because there's tons of lager and it's very cheap lager. So he sings like that and he goes, Now, if Jeff turns around and says, you know what, I need to go outside and have a cigarette now, does the entire football match come to a pause awaiting Jeff's return? No, it does not. No, it doesn't. It just doesn't. And that's nothing against Jeff. We don't have anything against Jeff. We don't think, we're not judging Jeff. We're not seeing Jeff as inferior. We're saying in this particular arena, Jeff is not as important as other people in the stadium. And the reason for that is that he is not as justifying as anyone else. Because the real reason most people are there is to watch a game of football take place. Are you comfortable with that? Are you comfy with that? Yeah? Are you comfortable with that so far? We're there to watch a football game. Now, if the captain of the football team, just before they, like, they flick a coin, don't they, to see who's going to kick off, right? So just before they say, hold on, I must just go and have a cigarette. He's obviously got a bad habit. So he runs out through the tunnel and he stands at the back and goes, just have to have a quick cigarette because I can't play without myself. I forgot my pre-match cigarette. Everyone would have to wait. Why would everyone have to wait for that person? Because the captain of that particular football team is more important than Jeff. Even though he's doing the same thing that Jeff is doing, the captain is more significant in that arena. Is everyone okay with the moshel? Is everyone okay with the analogy? Okay. They're coming now to the nimshel, coming to the point of that analogy. The Derech Hashem explained that there are people in the world who are more justified in being in the world because of their actions. And their justification therefore makes them globally more important than others. Now that was a very difficult thing to accept because it's emotionally unpleasant, uncomfortable to accept that there are people who are more important from a justificational rationale that we talked about in section one of being in the world from those that aren't. So some people who are justifying the system are therefore more important and more influential from an overall legal, spiritual perspective than others. Now that took weeks of work, and I mean 3 weeks of work, which adds up to something like 4.5 hours of solid work. And there was arguments, and there was, but Rabbi, what about this? And we'll firebomb this, and if you don't say that, we'll picket this. And we worked through it, and it wasn't that violent. And we worked through it, or militant, and it was great, and we worked through it, and that was done. Is everyone comfortable with that concept so far? That some people are more justified than others. And we were talking specifically about the righteous. Righteous means that 51% or more of those people's deeds are in line with what God would want them to do in any given situation, as opposed to being out of line. A righteous person means that the majority of their deeds is in line, and a Rosha, a wicked person as we're defining it now, like coming back to the concept of Rosh Hashanah, is just where 49 or less percent of an individual's deeds are in line. We always judge an individual by the majority. It's like we don't ever judge them. God's system judges them, but we can't possibly judge an individual because it's too fine. It's too fine cut. That's so far so good. Those are some of the consensus. Is this ringing any bells? Like, I can't remember. For the people that were here, is everyone up to date with all this? It's like, not as if I'm like, oh my God, you've completely changed your story. We're to do with Snoopy. And you've ruined it. No, it's everyone's comfortable so far. Are there any questions just on the points that I've asked so far that require clarification? No. Is that okay so far? Okay. We discussed that. That was a very difficult and long topic. We got over that hump. And then we started talking about the differences between Jews and Gentiles. And the thing that we discussed last time, which is where we're now actually in, we're going to jump halfway in to the chapter of Israel and the nations. We discussed last time is what is a Jew and what is a Gentile? I mean, what actually is a Jew and a Gentile? And the answer was absolutely incredible. Who made the Jews? Remember I asked at the, I think the beginning or halfway through the beginning, of last session, which was the sixth session of term five, is who made the Jews? And everyone had another answer. It was Abraham, or it was Isaac, or it was Jacob, or it was Pharaoh, and it was Morph, or it was Mr. Lego. Who made the Jews? And the answer, the shocking answer that we came to was Ronnie. What was the shocking answer that we came to? It's Ronnie. By the way, this is the hot seat. Now notice you didn't sit in the hot seat. Yeah, excuse me, because Andy took it out. Ronnie, he sits there. Now you get pummeled. If you're in this seat, you've got to be really, you know, you've got to be in for it. You've got some mood. Whether you're in the mood for that night, you don't want to sit there. It's a mood you've got to be in. You know what I mean? So, Ronnie, what do you remember who it is that made the Jews? When I asked who made the Jews,
I know what it is, the receipt of the Torah in Har Sinai.
Very good. Hashem. That defined an interim. There was no Jews before the giving of the Torah. That's excellent. But who actually made the Jews then?
Hashem made the Jews.
Hashem made
the Jewish people made the Jews by accepting.
Well, that's half true. The Jews by saying yes.
Yeah. Other nations. The other nations by refusing.
Oh, that was it. Very good. It was all the other nations by saying, we looked at the offer. We appreciate very much the sales pitch. We've asked what the small print is. We've gone through it with you. And we graciously decline the offer. And we would like not to accept this enhanced version of rules. Remember, they've already got their version of rules. What are the rules that all nations have to abide by? Does anyone know what that's called? The seven Noahide laws, right? Which the seven Noahide laws, which are brought in Gemara Sanhedrin, page 56a, and the Rambam in Hilchas Malachim, chapter 9, halacha 1. And those seven laws are, number one, is they're not allowed to worship idols. Number two, they must bless the divine name, which means they have to have some kind of format of prayer for themselves. Number three is they mustn't murder. Number four is there is a list of prohibited sexual transgressions. Number five are the laws of theft and civil law, jurisprudence. Number six is a court system. They must set up a court system in order to enforce the above laws. And that was the six Adamic laws. The seventh Noahide law, which was added after the flood, was no cruelty to animals, okay? Under the principle of Eva Menachai, okay? So, all humanity had that Torah, as it were. All humanity had that particular... Torah means what? What does the word Torah mean? Sorry?
Law.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. Halacha, what does the word halacha mean? From the root halach. Right, which way to actually go? How to manifest that concept. But Torah means law, okay? Torah means law or teaching, okay? So the Torah that they had, the teaching that they had, was the seven Noahide laws. God came and said, right, we're going to enhance those laws, which are still binding on humanity. We're going to bump it up. Who wants to take on the extra mitzvahs? People looked at it and said, well, this is quite a kind of a challenge, quite a few lifestyle challenges, which frankly, I don't feel as if I want to take on board. I really don't want to do that. They're bugging me. I feel as if it's getting in my way. And I really don't want to do that. Now, quick question. I think we discussed this last time. We judge a nation by the whole. Let's say there's 100,000 people. I'm making that up. There's many, many more than 100,000. But each nation, each of the 70 nations, was asked, do you want to do this? And they all had their own individual revelation moment simultaneously. And then they all said no. And then God was gathered unto Sinai, which means he came from them to us. So we got asked last. There was two groups of asking, everyone else and us, and everyone else was simultaneous. And we discussed why that was, so God could offset questions saying, who did you ask first, did you ask second? If they would have said yes, they would have said, et cetera, et cetera. And we said that if you've got 100,000 people, how do we judge a yes or a no vote? Does anyone remember how we judge a yes or no vote? Lee, do you remember how we judge a yes or no vote? When God came to a nation, let's say Edom, Asaph, and said, Asaph, do you want the Torah? And I said, well, what's in it? And I said, well, now you're asking, really, you shouldn't be asking me because it's kind of rude, but now you're asking, I'll tell you what's hard for you. The hard thing for you is thou shalt not kill. But thou shalt not kill, but we live by the sword. I mean, that's like saying thou shalt not play darts and all we do is have darts. So no, right? How did we judge a yes or a no? Or how did not we? How did God judge a yes or a no?
Was it back to the majority?
Excellent. As linan acha haroiv, we adjudicate according to the majority. So God adjudicated according to majority. Now, what does that mean? Now, if there was 100,000 people, that means we need 50,001 people to say, yeah, let's do it, right? Now, what happens if 49,999 people said, yeah, let's do it? They didn't get the Torah. Is that fair? Yeah, because if you're judging by majority, that's the system, right? It's got to go first across the line, okay, go, guys. That's fair. But God never forgot a yes. If someone put up their hand and said, that sounds like a fantastic idea, I'm very happy to take that on wholeheartedly. But unfortunately, they're part of a nation which said, no, I don't want to do it. Those people can't nationally join Judaism, but they can individually join Judaism. How do they do that? All together now. Come on, guys, come on. I know it's the first... Sorry? Through the conversion process. Now, there was a mass conversion process at Mount Sinai where everyone became Jewish simultaneously. But that never happens again. There's no mass conversions in Judaism. Indeed, the beginning of Islam was where Muhammad came with a bunch of devotees and all wanted to mass convert to Judaism. An interesting thing, research that. He wanted to convert to Judaism. The first Quran was written by a Jew because he was the only literate person in town. Very interesting. And Muhammad indeed married a 9-year-old Jewish girl. Very interesting. But he came with a whole bunch of people and he said, listen, we want to convert to Judaism. And the Jews of the local area said, I'm sorry, but we don't do mass conversions. It's not a service we offer. But if you know, but if you're all individually interested in becoming Jews, fuck a shot. There's a process to go through. You have to prove your worth. You really got it, like, you show us you want to do. And then if I can show you, part of family, if that's what you want to do. But you can't just say, look, you know what? You know, go around sprinkling holy water and have this special chewing gum, and that's it. And 450 people will become Jewish. It doesn't work like that. Each individual has to say, I want to do it now. That's how it works, okay? Everyone comfortable with that? So no mass conversions. But at Sinai, there's a mass conversion potential. Had the other nations have all said, yeah, like 51,000 or what is it? Yeah, where they are. The whole world would have been converted to Judaism. Absolutely incredible. That was a mass conversion opportunity which was never to be repeated. It's interesting that when the Messiah comes, all bote dinim, all houses of judgment that do conversion in the world, have to stop converting. Because people are going to want to become Jewish once that happens, and we doubt their sincerity. Because a lot of people always want to join the winners, right? Okay? When the Messiah comes in, everyone's going to go, yeah, they're the winners, I want to be Jewish too. Well, I'm sorry, we've shut shop. Okay, that's an interesting side point, but we could maybe talk about that later. But everyone gets the point so far. I see. See, now look, this is the first time someone has put up their hand and wants to ask a question. So what we'll do is dynamically go to Adrian. It's so good to see you, Adrian.
Is this the opportunity that the flow of Judaism goes, instead of from the father to the son, it goes from the mother?
I'm not sure I even understand the question. Okay, Judaism is matrilineal because we learn out about intermarriage. In the Torah talks about intermarriage, that if you marry Gentile daughters, then those children are considered Gentiles, so then it's matrilineal or patrilineal. The only thing which is patrilineal in Judaism is your clan affinity. Notice I use the word clan and not tribe, everybody. It's one of my pet things that I'm trying to undo. One little thing I can do is possibly undo this whole 12 tribe business. It's not 12 tribes, it's 12 clans. Okay? 12 clans. Or the father is a descendant of one of the 12 men who started the clans, right? And that is what the father can give over. Which is why generally men today just define in a marriage relationship who's Ashkenazi and who's Sephardi. So if you marry a Sephardi man, generally, even if the woman isn't Sephardi, she joins his quote-unquote clan. And today that's Sephardi and Ashkenaz, or Hasidish. Now we say generally Sephardim come from the tribe, I did it myself. Because, you know, I was like, what can I do? It's not easy. So if not easy for me, I can go easier on you, right? Sephardim, we generally say, come from the clan of Judah. And Ashkenazim generally come from the clan of Benjamin. Okay? That is the story that we have, okay? So, yes, that's... Yeah, you could. I've never heard that before. It could be nonsense. I don't know. I won't accept it until I hear from someone more reputable, but I'll put it down in my book and who knows. That's okay, get it. It's fine. You know, it's all. These are all just... It's just advice. That's what we say. Yeah, it's Benjamin and Yehuda. It's okay. Benjamin and Yehuda is Sephardim and Ashkenazim. So if a woman from Benjamin, an Ashkenazi woman, let's say, marries a Sephardi man who we generally say is from the tribe of Yehuda, she would take on his customs. That doesn't mean she becomes Jewish by marrying him. I don't know what you're asking, really, but I hope that was interesting in and of itself. I mean, can I carry on? I'm sorry, I don't know what he's asking. I could have been an auntie. I don't know. It's going to be like this all the way through, guys. New people, this is how it is. You may like it. Sometimes people get with it. Some people don't. Some people describe this thing like Marmite. Either love it or hate it. Okay? I don't know, it's not for everyone, but we can give it a go and I'll try to make it as Marmite with something nice, like butter, as possible. Thin Marmite, maybe. Okay, how did I get thin Marmite? Ah, yes, I was talking about the fact that there was mass conversions, etc. We don't do mass conversions, we do individual conversions. Now, if someone comes up with a business contract to you and they offer you double glazing or something like that and you accept, then you take on the double glazing and you get all the benefits of the double glazing and you have to pay for the double glazing. That sounds fair in my book. Does that sound fair in everyone else's book? So everything is warmer, it's quieter, but you have to pay. You have to pay. It works like that in life, yeah? If you say, no, I don't come knocking on my door with double glazing and keep away no junk mail. Okay, but if I can show you, don't get bothered by the people going, excuse me, there's lovely houses, but you don't have double glazing, maybe you should have double glazing. Oh, so I don't want to get bothered because I just want to come home at night, put my feet up, drink a little thing, go to bed. I don't want to get people knocking on my door going, oh, what about double glazing? No, I don't want that, so leave me alone. Now, the problem with that is you don't get the benefit of double glazing. That's fair, right? Is that fair? That sounds okay with everyone? It's a life thing, okay? Just like a life education thing. You know, I never knew that if you didn't take double glazing, you don't get the benefit from it. Okay, so if Hashem offers you the Torah and you say, yes, I'll take it, well, there's a payment. There's a lifestyle change in order to accommodate that, but you get a tremendous benefit out of it. It's quieter and you don't hear all the cars going around at night. That's an analogy, obviously, right? You're with me, okay, on the analogy. If you say, no, I want the Torah, it's too much like hassle, then the Vakasha, you don't pay for the Torah, but you don't get the benefits of the Torah. Does that sound fair? I mean, that sounds like a business deal. Indeed, it was a strict business deal. It was a marriage, a full marriage, which is the closest relationship that humans can bond with. God said, I want a full marriage. These, the luchas, the two tablets, acted as the kesef kedushin, the betrothal money, which has a legal status when the groom gives it to the bride. And the Torah itself acts as the ketubah in Sephardi, which acts as the marriage contract, which details the sides of what each party should do in order to be able to keep the marriage chal, live or active. So far, so good. On top of that, by the way, God forced us into a situation. I believe I discussed this in section one. God lifted up the entire Mount Sinai over us and said, right, now that you've accepted it, I'm going to do a little very interesting thing here. Harkigigis, which is in our Gemara Shabbos, page 88a. It says as follows. Either you can accept the Torah, which we've already accepted, again, tell me you accepted, or I'm actually going to squash you all to death under this mountain. Now that's an interesting challenge. But we've really said yes. Yes, but now I want you to say yes or die. Do you remember this? We discussed this in term one for people in term one. Why did God do that? There's a special law. There's a special law that we discussed. that says if a man were to force a woman into marriage, he puts a gun to her head and says, marry me or die, the truth is she still has a choice. Right? Right, ladies? She could say, listen, better the bullet than you. Okay? Okay, listen, I know that I want to smell roses and I've got things I want to do in life and stuff like that. But if it means living with you, I'd rather take the bullet. She could say no. She could. But the vast majority is, what can I do? I've got to save my life. So she'll say yes. Now, in that particular case, if the wife doesn't want to divorce the man, the halacha is that the man is forbidden from ever divorcing the wife. So let's say she's got a problem. She takes the Beis Din. Beis Din says, you've been really mean to her. So she can get divorced, get the kesubah, right? Which is the payment from the kesubah. But if he says, oh, she's terrible at this, and she makes jelly too runny, and I wish to divorce her. Which is not, guys, it's not a good reason to divorce your wife if she makes jelly runny. I just want to say that. It was an example. Just throw, you know, these things are examples. Don't take that too literally. So she makes a jelly too runny, I wish to divorce her. Takes the Beis Din. The Beis Din say, listen, in your particular case, you forced her into a marriage, and therefore it is forbidden for us to relieve you from the marriage. We can't do that. You have to stay married to her. God did that subsequently to us, free will, volitionally accepting the Torah, in order to wrap himself into that law that he wouldn't be able to divorce us should he find us wanting. So we can never turn around and say, gosh, maybe God will divorce us. Maybe God will say, listen, we've behaved so badly. We've been so errant. We've gone astray to such an extent that we're simply a wayward wife, which would be the right thing to do is to get rid of her. He can't do that because he's bound himself by his own rules to stick with us through thick and thin, through anything. That's something that he's done, okay? That's part of the deal, which means he can't give us a bill of divorce because of the Harka Gigis issue, because of holding up the mountain over us like that. He says, I can't do that anymore. That's a legal precept. Is everyone up to date with a legal precept? Is everyone comfortable? Okay. We then said that this has made a profound difference between Jews and Gentiles. Gentiles were only different from Jews at that cataclysmic moment when Jews said, yeah, okay, we'll do it. Then something changed. Now, this has spiritual ramifications. Remember, Jews have their job and Gentiles have their job. And when God created Adam, what was Adam? Come on, guy, please. I know it's the beginning of a term. Come on, give me some energy here. Maybe any lemon. He was Gentile. He was just a human. He was just a human being. God wanted humanity. He didn't separate between Jews and Gentiles. He just had Adamarition. That's all he had. He wasn't like he was Jewish, he wasn't Jewish. It's just who he had, right? So the differentiation between Jew and Gentile only happened at Mount Sinai, which means now there's a differentiation between roles of Jews and Gentiles. That had never happened before. There was no differentiation of role. There was just humanity doing its job. And now that humanity has slid down to the point where we're going to have to repatriate them, he's offering the healing prescription to everyone, but at a volition basis. And everyone, not everyone says, I want to take the medicine. Well, but Vakasha, I've got to have one person, someone's got to take the medicine to justify it for everyone else, right? Otherwise, what am I keeping humanity going for? Now, remember, we talked about roots and branches. I've got to just recap about roots and branches. Humanity was extremely potent. When Mitzrayim, who was the son of Ham, settled in North Africa, he put a flag in the ground and called the place Mitzrayim. That's crazy. That's like me turning up to somewhere in Berry, putting a flag in the ground and calling the place Mitchell. That's ridiculous. This is Mitchell. Because people were so potent, people were so intense, their personalities were so absolutely, they were roots, they had tremendous spiritual potential. What they did is, they were incredible. God noticed, he gave them this, obviously, in order that they can repatriate themselves to the level of Adam before he sinned. But humanity was slipping and slipping and slipping and slipping to such a degree that God changed the roots and branches system so that people now are only branches from their archetypal root. The system of change started when? When did God say that the system of roots and branches of humanity must now change? The people are roots at the moment. Whatever they do will change humanity forever. But there's going to be a thing, I've looked into it with his highest wisdom. He looked into it and said, if I let this go on anymore, humanity will corrupt itself to the point of getting to another mubble. And I've promised that I won't flood the earth again. So I've got to stop it here because it's the last point in time that we could possibly repatriate humanity. When was the watershed, no pun intended, when was the watershed moment in humanity? Marcus. Oh, Ronnie, you beat him to it. You see, you got you out of it. But I don't think you heard. Go on, say it louder. The Tower of Babel. Excellent. God said, right, that's it. What we're going to do is make a separation between humanity now as a root system and a branch system. Now, that's when Ne'ilah happened. What does Ne'ilah mean? Closing of the doors. How long did he give humanity during the Ne'ilah period? When did it really shut finally? Avram was around at the Tower of Babel. He was there. He was there. He was 14 at the time of Tower of Babel. So if the doors are closed, God says, right, I'm going to change humanity forever. When did it really end? When did humanity say, that's it, there's going to be a differential between humanity now forever, and there's no going back?
Giving of the Torah.
Very good, Dovi. Giving of the Torah, that's the end of it. Now, the Torah gave in 2448, and the Tower of Babel was in 1996, which means that there was a 452-year Ne'ilah. There was a closing gap where humanity could still go back to really being the roots, if they should have desired, for almost half a millennia. 452 years is quite a long Ne'ilah, would you not say? I mean, that would be very too long for my local synagogue. Could you imagine? We will now start the Ne'ilah service and finish in 452 years. So, but my dinner's ready in just a couple of hours. I'm sorry. It's late. I know, you're doing so well to be here. Okay. So fine. So you've got a 452-year Ne'ilah. 452 years. Once that 452 years draw to a close with a cataclysmic Matan Torah experience, humanity must undergo an irrevocable change. That's it. Everyone's a branch, no one's a root. And now there's a differentiation between Jew and non-Jew, between those that have accepted the additional bonus bumper pack of the Torah, and those that said, no, we'll stick with the Shefer Mitzvos Noach, the seven Noachad laws. Is everyone up to speed of what I'm saying so far? So we started off recapping the concept of justification, that the righteous justify those who are less righteous by being there because they're like the captains of the football team. The thing is that anyone can become righteous. You can become a captain of the football team. All you have to do is get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and kick a ball about in the snow until you get good enough to become a football player. If you're willing to put the time in, you too can become a captain, right? If you're not willing to put that time in, then those that do justify you going to watch the football. Then we've got the differentiation between Jew and Gentile. Then we've got the differentiation between roots and branches. It's a lot to discuss, especially for the new people who are here. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. This is all very, 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 yeah. But basically, it's a general recap. Lots more to... That's a fantastic sound. Lots more to listen to. Lots more to listen to on the downloads. And of course, I'm available for questions afterwards or by email as well, which I get a tremendous amount of. And I'm sorry if I can't reply to all of them. I do have other things as well in my life to do.
Can I ask you a question now?
Yes, you most certainly can.
Just before the gates close,
yes.
You've got someone from...
It's good, that, isn't it? I've been practicing that for years.
You've got someone from Edom who said yes. I mean, I'm up for this Torah thing. And then you've got someone from
Israel
who said, not for me.
Oh, excellent question. No one said it wasn't for me, though. No one said that. Yes,
then.
Excellent. What happened to those yeses?
First time the Jews ever agreed on anything. The last time, probably, as well.
You should know. You're making a joke. For the tape, for people who can't hear, what's your name again?
Andy.
Andy said, the first time Jews ever agreed on it. That's true, en masse, they agreed. But you know, deep down in their hearts, many wanted to say no. But they were too scared of retribution, says the Medrash. The non-Jews who came out with the Jews as part of Moses' outreach, the Erev, the mixed multitude, they really didn't want it. But they were terrified that the Erev Cotton, the small group who were actually the descendants of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, would kill them if they said no. So they all accepted it, but they were considered, to a certain extent, insincere converts. But because it was a mass conversion ceremony, God didn't undo it and say, gosh, now that I have to go back, which is why the Sfuno explains, the Sfuno is an Italian commentator, a Middle Ages Italian commentator, one of the Rishonim, says that one of the reasons God led the Jews around the desert for 40 years was to try to shake them. He says that. That's one of the reasons God did that. Led them around to say, listen, we're bored of this. This is not going anywhere. Let's go home. He said that's actually one of the reasons. So all the Jews, remember, all the Gentiles that came with them became Jewish. It was a mass conversion for anyone that was there. Anyone that said yes, got it. They all became Jews. But that's why God said to Moses, go down from this mountain, for the people you took out of Egypt have defiled themselves. These aren't my people. It's not my project. This is your project. You've got your own project going on. Those guys are doing what they're doing. I'm doing what I'm doing. Please, could you go organize your people? Okay, because this is not my problem.
Yeah.
Now, they all said yes. Because they all said yes, they're all fully fledged Jews. All of them. However, many of their hearts, the Medrash said, were saying, we don't want to do any of this. They were also the first to complain about the man.
Yeah.
They said, listen, and when they were talking about man, by the way, they said, what's the Hebrew word, by the way, for meat?
Basar.
What does basar mean? Fantastic. The word basar doesn't mean meat. It means flesh. Now, when they left Egypt, if you add up, if you do a calculation from the Medrash, they walked out with 90 million head of cattle, totally draining all the bovines out of the entire country of Egypt. There's nothing left. Literally, we gutted the place. Like a child who exits the womb, everything comes out of the womb. The womb, the placenta, the lining, everything. It just guts is. Egypt was the womb of Israel. 90 million head of cattle. The Erev Rav didn't like the mum because it was based upon your spiritual standing, how close it fell. So they went to Moses and said, we want basar. Now he took that to mean meat. Now he said to God, oh, if all the fish in the sea were caught, would they be comfortable with that? If I caught them all the fish, they got 90 million head of cattle. They can't shecht a few and make themselves some burgers or a barbecue. They have to come. God got it. Goes, they didn't ask for meat. They asked for basar. They asked for flesh. What they were really concerned about were the 21 forbidden conjugal relationships, which now the Torah has forbidden, but which were permitted previously. You can no longer marry your aunt or your sister, just the way, or stepsister or half sister. You can't do it. So they were like, we want flesh. And what did Moses hear? So say, we want meat. This food is insubstantial. What we want is flesh. Get it? So he went to God and said, they want meat. Moses says, let me deal with them. I'll deal with it. I got that. Moses, you can go back and tell them they're going to get their flesh. Moses like, God, you've been really angry, God. You have. You've been really not. I was like, I get it. I know what your problem is. There were those that were insincere, but they converted nonetheless. So when you say they all agreed on it, they all agreed it under, to a certain extent, duress. But some from Edom said, I really, genuinely, sincerely wish to ascribe to this way of life. Those individuals are not forgotten.
No, sure. But okay. What I was going to say was, so after that Torah, is that there's no spirit qualitatively, there's a spiritual difference between those two people.
Yes.
Even though one wanted and one didn't really want.
That's correct.
So something happened.
Yes. Spiritually.
Changed them.
That's correct. Which is what happens at the conversion ceremony, by the way.
Yeah.
When an individual goes to the conversion ceremony, the real moment of conversion is when? When at mikveh?
Dunking.
At the dunking?
No,
the second they emerge from the waters of mikveh. That's when it happens. That's the moment. That's when you literally unplug and replug in a new spiritual construct. So that moment. You get jacked into a totally different broadband data stream. That's really what happens. It's a faster data stream. Okay? Jack, are you Yaakov Ezra or Jack? What?
Jack.
Who's Yaakov Ezra then?
That's my ego.
Okay, fine. Can I, Yaakov Ezra, stroke. Jack, stroke. Lovely person in the middle seat there.
Now, I just want to ask about the years 1996 and 2448.
Yeah.
Why were they the turning points of... and
the branches. Okay, we discussed that. That's an excellent question. That's a brilliant. Does everyone get the question? What happened at 1996, which is the Tower of Babel and 2448? The Tower of Babel was a concerted human effort to kick God out of this world. Okay? People got together and said, God can jolly well have his heaven, and we are going to be masters of our own destiny. God understood at that point that if he lets humanity slide on this slippery slope continually, keeping humanity at root would actually be dangerous for them. How can I ask how old you are?
16.
16. Your father's in the room. Can I turn to your father and ask him a question with your permission? I'm now turning to Jack's father. Jack's father. Good evening. Jack comes to you in a moment of tremendous Ace Rutzon. You have a tremendous moment of chain for him. He says, Dad, can I ask you a favour? And you literally can ask for anything and you give it to him. And he turns to him and says, Dad, can I have the keys to your car? I want to go out for a joyride. Okay, now, this is for the tape. It's going to get broadcast. He's going to be careful. He's a lot. He knows. Okay. What are you... What are you going to really say? He's obviously not insured and anything like that. And it's not on your own property. He wants to joyride at night through the back streets. You know, it's late. Would you give him the keys to your car?
Not again.
Not a second time. Not after what happened last Thursday. We're still fixing that up, you know. Not again. I doubt you do it once. I mean, if you're... Now, let's say, oh, Dad, please, please, I really love it. The sound of it and the gears and everything, I love it. Why would Jack's dad tell him no?
Because it's not good for him.
Right, at the end of the day, Jack's dad wants to give Jack as much pleasure as Jack can take. But if Jack truly had the keys to Jack's dad's car and he wraps it around a tree post, forget the car, Jack's in danger. Do you agree? Do you not agree that as much as you'd want to do it, as much as you really, really want to drive that car, it's actually extremely dangerous for you and other people around you? Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Okay, you want to hire out the Nürburgring and just knock yourself out. Do what you want, you know, but not on public roads. And if your father's looking out for you, he won't let you do that either. The answer's like this. God realized, he wants the best for humanity. He only created everything for humanity. The whole universe, eggs, giant squid, peanut butter, comets, are all made only for humanity. We discussed and justified that. What about extraterrestrials and there's 18,000 worlds with sentient beings? Yeah, that's great. It's all made for humanity and there's a rationale behind that and they have their role, we have our role. But in the meantime, if you are allowed to play with power tools where you're starting to lose your grip on your role, you're going to damage yourself. We have to shut the door. But it's a 452-year no. The door really shuts when a choice has to be made. Are you going to commit or aren't you going to commit to a repatriation? If the answer's no, then it's no forever. And your role will be set aside as a less central role in a rectification of the universe. If you say yes, then it's a chance for everything you like it. Look, we're all born Jews. Not necessarily if we like it. If you wake up in the morning, you're Jews because you're born Jews. This is because you chose to convert. You are born because what can you do? So what can you can't turn around and shirk the responsibility. Your great, great, great parents signed you up for this. That's now the way it is. It's a change. That was a commitment that someone made. That's how it works. Yeah? There's a 452 commitment. Once that commitment's happened, that's the end of it. There's no going back on that. It only has to happen once. That's why mutton toy doesn't need to happen every single day. It's just a cataclysmic event. Once you make the choice, you make the choice. You don't have to get remarried every day. Imagine people reorganize their vows every single day of the week. Wouldn't it get boring? What are you doing? We're getting married to show how committed we are to each other. Why do you need to do that? You get married once, enough is enough. Everyone knows you, Mr. and Mrs. Finished. No, because maybe I really didn't take the commitment properly then. Yes, I did. So I'll do it today and tomorrow. It gets ridiculous. Why do you make the commitment? You get on with life and now you're married. Do you understand the answer? Do you feel comfortable with that?
Yeah.
Anyone else got any? Yes. Yeah, at the back.
You were saying before about Shem threatened
to put the mountain on. Yes, Harker Gigis. As I explained, they had to accept the Torah of their own complete free volition, which they did. He then asked them again, are you going to accept the Torah, even if it's a matter of life or death? And they said, yeah. And the issue there is, now they're being threatened in a life and death situation, it changes their legal status as a bride who has been forced into a marriage, which forces the groom into a difficult legal status where he cannot divorce the bride no matter what happens later in the relationship, unless she so decided. So he did that because, obviously knowing about what happened with the destruction of the temples and where Jews did and didn't go with their Judaism, that really technically maybe he would have wanted to have divorced us, but he can't, and he's forcing himself to stick by us through thick and thin. Is everyone up to speak? Yes, Elliot, is it Laser?
Yeah.
Laser at the back, lovely to see you. The 318 souls that he made in Haran, you're talking about, they all flit. Even though they themselves became converts, only one individual stuck it out, and that was Eliezer. All the other disciples didn't have children who kept the same path that they themselves chose to do. It's interesting that Eliezer, Eved Avraham, Eliezer, the servant of Abraham, is one of the seven people that ascended into heaven alive, along with Elijah, Serach, Chezkiel, Jonah was another one, Jonah the prophet. He's one of the seven people that ascended alive into heaven. It's Eliezer, Eved, Avraham. The other individuals just kind of melted away. Some say, well, this is parenthetically now, this is Bederach Agav, some of the sources state, one of the reasons that happened was to make a clear differentiation between Isaac and his offspring and those other individuals, had they have stuck with it, who really would have been Jewish at the time. Now that could be a legal, that's a very nice way of legally saying that it's very clear where the scion
no
is.
Jewish, I thought no one was...
That's true, but if they would have all had children following the paths of Abraham and they didn't go down to Egypt, then who really was the people, and then who's offering the Torah becomes complicated. So they would have to be subsumed into Isaac's children, etc., etc., because Sarah gave everything she had to Isaac, which includes Ishmael, which was a slave boy. Ishmael was born of a slave maiden that she had. So he has the din of a slave hand owned wholly and utterly by Sarah, which means everything he picks up, by the way, that Alshach HaKadosh explains, everything he picks up belongs to the mistress in this case. He was owned outright by Sarah Imenu. Sarah gave everything she had to Isaac, which means that Isaac inherited Ishmael and everything that he has. So legally, everything that Ishmael has is belonging to Yitzchak. Okay? So there was a very, very clear line as to who's who. Okay? That's a particular story. Did that answer that question? You feel comfortable about that answer? We're actually going to open the book. Isn't this a wonderful moment?
Ring the bell.
Hello. That's a real moment. Well, that's harder. We have to work harder to get to that moment. Ring the bell. You know, yeah, nearly. Dobby, okay, I'll see you. See, it's lovely to see you. Thank you so much for being here. Okay, it's fine. Okay, lovely to see you. People, we are at the bottom of page 139. But what I'd like to do, just to give holistic closure to what we've said today, is go back to the bottom of page 137, if you don't mind. Is that okay? Bottom of page 137. And we're going to go over where it says, God then scrutinizes. The second in-depth up on the page, by the shoulder note in the generation separation. Is everyone comfortable? Does everyone have the page? So we're bottom of page 137, second indent up from the bottom. God then scrutinized all mankind, perceiving the levels that should be made permanent in that generation's members according to their deeds. So he's looking at these roots and saying, right, we're going to change roots into branches. What of the roots' characteristics are we going to preserve that the branches will always be like nationally? What's going to be India? What's going to be China? What's going to be Korea? What is really going to be these 70 nations? These things then became a permanent part of their nature in the aspect as roots, which means it can never be undone. That's it forever. Okay? It was thus decreed that they each should bear future generations. But all those future generations possessing the qualities that were deemed appropriate for their root ancestor. They're now an outcome of what came before. They can't change the internal characteristics of their particular nation. They now can just live it to the best that they can. The descendants of each of these individuals were thus divided into permanent groupings, each with its own characteristics and limitations, basically parameters that they can and can't operate in. They were destined to father future generations who would inherit these characteristics, just as members of any particular species inherit the characteristics of their forebears. Giraffes all tend to be tall and spotty. You very rarely find a short giraffe that doesn't have any spots. That's because the original giraffe was tall and spotty, right? So too, if you have a nation, India or China, that particular nation's characteristics are the top characteristics. As it flows down, they all have the same kind of middah. According to the highest judgment, it turned out that none of them deserved to rise above the degraded level to which Adam and his children had fallen as a result of their sin. Although that was the point of making them roots, giving them the ability to overcome that and improve their degraded level, none of them did it. Not a single one had risen above it all. There was, however, one exception, and that was Avraham Avinu. And that was 20 generations after Adam, 10 from Adam to Noah, 10 from Noah to Abraham, and that source is in Pirkei Avos, the Ethics of the Fathers, chapter 5, Mishnayos, Mishnah 1 through 4. Okay? He had succeeded in elevating himself as a result of his deeds and was chosen by God. Notice, though, Was Abraham, in all of his greatness, able to undo the sin of Adam? No, absolutely not. Was Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob combined able to undo the degradation of the sin of Adam? No. Are we all and all Jews together over all the generations up until today able to undo the degradation by the sin of Adam? No, because the second it happens, it'll get fixed. So you haven't done it yet. So even as great as Abraham was, he still couldn't undo it, as great as he was. Abraham was therefore permanently made into a superior, excellent, quote-unquote, tree, i.e. a source of branches. We are connected to this root trunk, conforming to man's highest level. It was further provided that he, Abraham, would be able to produce branches and father a nation. That was the whole thing. God said, I'm going to make you like stars and nations. I'm going to make you into a nation, possessing specifically his characteristics. Okay. The world was then divided into 70 nations, each with its own particular place in the general scheme. All of them, however, remained on the level of man in a fallen state, while only Israel was in an elevated state, yet even Israel was not like Adam and Rishon before the sin. All they had here was a better chance of making more of a dent into the damage done. After this, the gate was closed on the era of roots. Things would then be directed and, I've underlined, brought about upon via providence, I've added, which is what we discussed in the previous chapter. That's via providence, brought about upon individuals as branches through providence. Both individual and general. Remember, general is environmental, genetic, and horoscopic factors. Individual providence is an outcome of the response of man's free will decisions. That's quite a bit of revision there. Just for those that are holding on at this time of night. Each one according to his nature. I am trying though, who knows? Okay, even though it may seem that man was originally the same as he is now, there is actually a great difference. Before the generation of separation, in 1,996 years from Adam's birthday, man existed in the age of roots and was dealt with accordingly. I've put a note in on his level of providence. God interfaced with humanity on a different level and a different level of closeness and intensity on those days up until 1996 than he does now. When this period ended, things were judged and made permanent and a new age of humanity began. This is the age of branches, which still exists. Okay, this is where we got to at the end of last term. Point four.
Can I?
Absolutely. Is it Terry?
No, it's Andy.
Andy, I'm sorry. I don't know why I thought Terry. I'm sorry, I'm trying. So I'm very bad with
that. Why did Hashem have to say, now's the time the gates are going to close now?
I did address that earlier. I did address that earlier. The reason, in today, the reason is as follows. I think that was kind of Jack's question to a certain extent. Is that correct? Yeah. So it's like this. Humanity was not utilizing its potential correctly. Okay. It was actually misusing its potential and destroying its purpose and corrupting itself. Had God have kept such a powerful, potent power tool, super spirituality, within the hands of man at that time, man would have corrupted himself so thoroughly that the entire system would have been so kind of corrupted, adulterated, ruined, lost its potential, that you'd end up in a pre-flood situation again, where humanity simply wasn't worth going on with. So God said, to offset this, we're going to now change humanity's nature. Okay? Why didn't he just send the flood, a second flood? Because he's promised not to do it again. Now, he didn't do that in the first instance because he hadn't done the flood previously, which means he didn't have to say, let's change roots to branches prior to the flood. Let's just scrap it and start off with a kernel that's worth starting with. Now, he couldn't do that a second time round because he said, I'm not going to do that again.
Didn't he say to Moshe he'd start again with him?
You're quoting a Medrash. Andy's quoting a Medrash, just for the tape, because not everyone hears on the tape, and they say, I didn't hear what someone said. When Moses was on Mount Sinai, and the Jews had sinned at the golden calf, because of the Erevrov's initial instigation, but they didn't sufficiently protest, which means that they were also included among the guilty of that. God said, listen, leave me now, I'll kill everyone, and I'll make you into a nation of 600,000, we'll start again. So Moses understood from that, if I leave you now, you'll do that. If I don't leave you, you won't. So he stayed and he pleaded. Now, that's interestingly, God never undid the brocha. Moses miraculously had 600,000 descendants. Because God never, because he keeps a promise, but he didn't destroy Israel. I.e., God was saying, I've got to keep someone going who can justify the system. Moses said, look, justifiably, they can justify the system because they're all B'nai Avodah Zarah, they're all idol worship. They just come out of 240 years hard labor where the normal thing was idol worship. Give them a chance. I've been there 2 weeks. Give them a chance. I know you've shown them a lot over the past year, but look, you know, old habits die hard. They'll take it over. Give them a chance. And what will Egypt say? Imagine the papers tomorrow morning. Yes, exactly. God couldn't manage it. So I go, okay, it'll be a PR scandal. We can't have that. And I'm a spin doctor. I can't let that happen. So we got to grease the wheel over here. Now, the whole thing is, why did God get in that situation? We had that whole conversation. It was a beautiful concept. But that's the issue. The issue is that God had to change the situation of humanity at the generation dispersal because humanity was destroying itself. So for humanity's own preservation, it was the right thing to do at the time. Loretta, I can see a hand up.
No, I just thought it wasn't a midrash. I thought it was in the Chumash.
What was in the Chumash?
The fact, what you just said.
About yes, that was it. But the midrash discusses the whole secondary, the whole subtext, saying why is it that he should go back and forth and what should I do? And the whole thing about the 600,000 descendants coming out, it doesn't say that in the Chumash, but the midrash discusses that bracha was never taken away. Because when God gives you a positive and a negative, you can never undo the positive, but you can undo the negative. Right. We can always undo a negative prophecy, but we can never undo a positive prophecy. Okay, so far so good. Laser.
Why are we obliged to correct Adam
sin? What an excellent... Wow, that's... You know what? I really want to go into that, but... it's turn 1, 2, 3, 4, man. 5. I really want to go into that. That's a 10-minute answer. I'd love to discuss that. That is why I'm here, to discuss that. But you know what? I mean, after we've... I got to call cut on that. We're absolutely... Of course we're obliged. There's so much to discuss. I can't go into it. We've discussed that. 45 hours. 45 hours is a while. And you know, people, they're gonna wanna be here another half hour and they wanna split. They're not gonna wanna be here another 45 hours. I've had a thing in my life. As much as they like it here and as much as they're excited. You know what I'm saying? Good evening, it's lovely to see you. Do you need a copy of the book?
No.
You know what you can why not? Okay, you know, it's bonus. Okay. We are on page, bottom of page 139.4. For all those that have just joined us. I'm so lazy, I don't mean to dodge it. I want to answer your question. I'm bursting to answer it, but it's just not fair, do you know what I mean, on everyone else? Okay. Okay, I'm sorry. God's great love and goodness decreed that these branches of other nations still be given a chance. Give them a chance. If they so desired, they still had free choice to tear themselves loose from their own roots and through their own actions... include themselves among the branches of Avraham's family. What's the one word you have to add in at the corner here? What does this mean? What's all this paragraph saying? One word? Begins with a C, people. Conversion! Please write in here. This is the concept. That is what. This is a long way of saying what conversion is. Someone asks you, what is the Jewish concept of conversion? It is that you one has free choice to tear yourself loose from your own root and through your own action include yourself among the branches of Abraham's family. That is a definition of Jewish conversion. You seem, are you comfortable with that? You're a bit like, don't like it. Are you comfortable? You want to talk it out?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. This is what God meant when he told Abraham in Bereshis 12:3, that's Genesis 12:3, all the families of the earth will be blessed by you, Avraham. You'll be a father to the nations. Abraham was thus made the father of all converts. Now, this is a very interesting idea. When an individual, what is the Hebrew? What, if someone wants to say they're Jewish, how would you say that in Hebrew? If I, Yehudi. A Yehudi. Indeed, Moses was punished for calling himself an Ivri when he spoke to the daughters of Yisrael. He says, who I am, an Ivri. Really should say, I'm a Yehudi. I'm a Jew. Right? So why don't, when someone converts, we should say his name is, I don't know, let's call it, he calls himself Yeshaya. His name is Yeshaya HaYehudi, the Shaya the Jew. But what? How do we call him up? What do we say? We say Yeshaya Ben. Not just that. It shouldn't be that. That's what it is. practice wise, that's what we do. We should, right? The Gabbai should call up. Let's say the name's Yeshaya. The Gabbai say, Yamad Yeshaya ben Avraham Avinu Shlishi. He can't get Kona Levi, right? Because even though you can convert, you can't flip the guy on 50. Listen, I really like to go to Jesus, but you know what? Let's be a Karen. you can't do that. You can't call him up as a Karen, you know what I mean? As good as he'd like, you know? Oh, I'm sorry. So you really should call him up as Ben Avraham Avinu, but we don't. Because don't embarrass the fella, because people's names are Avraham. So maybe he could be, but the truth is, really he should be called up as, he's not the son of Avraham, any guy Avraham, down the road Avraham, he's the son of Avraham Avinu. That's because Avraham's the root. When someone converts, they're attaching Dafka to him. That's why they're called Ben Avraham, that's why they're called Ben Sarah. That's the root, and all the branches come out from there. So now, what does the word Ben mean? That's very important. When someone says you're a Ben Tyra, someone says, is he a Ben Tyra? What does that mean? Son of Tyra. Does that mean that the scrolls in this cupboard here have born you? And there was like a hospital bed with a sofa Tyra, and like it's got a thing around it, so I'm saying Mrs. Tyra, and it's like a baby. Is that what it means? Great, that's not what it means. What does Ben actually mean? Ascribes to the philosophy of dot, dot, dot. Ben whatever, if he's a Ben Avoider Zora, he ascribes to the philosophy of idol worship. If he's a Ben Bilam, then he ascribes to the philosophy of Bilam and his cohorts. If he's a Ben Tyra, he ascribes to the philosophy of Tyra. So Ben means I have attached myself to a certain method of thinking and living. That's what it means, Ben Avraham Avinu. He's attached to and ascribed to the methodology, philosophy, and lifestyle, Dafka of Abraham. Adrian, are you comfortable with everything I'm saying? Yes. Is there anything you would like to ask at this point? Lee.
You're Ben of your father, so obviously you're saying that you go the philosophy of your father, but you might not necessarily
That's
agree
a
with your
father. Fantastic. Lee is asking that. Brilliant question. My dad says it's only great to have bacon and eggs. And I don't ascribe to my dad's philosophy because I don't eat bacon and eggs because of, I don't know, cholesterol issues and Jewish things, right? So it's bacon and eggs is like not good for you, right? So now what does that mean? If I'm Ben, now, Ben means two things. Ben means I have come out from, and it means I ascribe to. One is passive, one is active. Do you hear this, Lee? I'm so glad you asked this question. Ben means I have come out from my father. There's nothing I can do to undo that. I contain 50% of the genetic material that I've inherited from my father. And 50% there's nothing I can do about that. I can't like rip out, I don't like those bits, it's rubbish, those bits. And I say, oh, there's new bit, look at that, I'll take that, it's brilliant. And you start morphing into like a plug of wood. It's like, it doesn't work like that, right? Everyone with me on this? That's a Ben, that's the passive, that's what you've inherited. But then through your life, you become a Ben of what you ascribe to. An individual can be born a Ben Tyra and leave Ben Tyra status. An individual can be born not a Ben Tyra and become a Ben Tyra because they've actively chosen to adapt to or adapt away from a particular ascribing of philosophy. But Ben is also an outcome. Ben also means, or Ben or Bas, notice the concept. Have you ever heard the term Bas Kol? A voice from heaven is called a bas kol. That means it's not actually the kol. It's the ramification, reflection of second filial generation of the kol. We'll talk about that in section 3 when we talk about prophecy, what prophecy really is. Which, by the way, is just a heightened state of consciousness. Doesn't mean God talking to you. No, it's a heightened state of consciousness is prophecy. We'll talk about that. Okay, we'll talk about that. So, a bas kol, when you hear the Torah, a bas kol came out and said, do this, it's a really good idea. That's what you're hearing is not actually the kol. It's a bas kol. It's a, notice feminine, which means it's even weaker. In Kabbalistic concept, it's weaker. It's even less of an outcome, right? It's not even the kol. You're not even hearing the kol. You're hearing the lowest possible emanation of the original kol. So, bas or ben mean a filial generation below, but they also mean that to which you actively ascribe. Does that answer your question? Is the difference between I'm the son of... Yeah, does that make sense? For instance, a convert certainly is not the son of Abraham. But when they convert, it's they have ascribed to the root of the Abrahamic tradition. Does that make sense? Is that clear to everyone? Okay. Okay, we're now at the last, the second to last indent on the page, right at the bottom. This is what God... Oh, I've done that. Okay, so the very last indent in the brackets. This, however, would require effort on the part of the individuals concerned. You can't just turn up one day and say, right, I'm Jewish. How do you feel? I remember I was in LA. I was talking in LA. And there's a cheapo conversion shop available there. Well, all you have to do is go down Venice Beach, dip in Venice Beach that afternoon, and you're considered Jewish. Okay, now, what really is... Are you, I guess you're as Jewish as you feel, right? But that doesn't mean everyone else will consider you Jewish. There's a certain way that you have to convert. You have to put effort in on the part of the individuals concerned. Then you can be considered Jewish, right? You have to do that. Without such effort, they would remain attached to their roots and retain their natural characteristics and therefore remain Gentile, despite the fact that they may proclaim themselves as Jewish, right? I don't know if this is the point. Is this the point now to discuss halachic and non-halachic conversion? Would anyone like to discuss that? Yeah, why not? It'd be fun. Okay, let's talk about halachic and non-halachic conversions. Part of what I do is I deal a lot with intermarriage and things like that, and why Jews should marry Jews, stuff like that. A very, very big part of what I do is why to marry Jewish. And a lot of young men or women who are engaged to someone who is Jewish and they themselves are not Jewish hit a quandary point when the family would like them to convert if that family is so inclined in the idea of they should marry someone Jewish. Okay? Now, when that happens, they hit a brick wall. And that brick wall is the conversion wall. And there's two conversions that are available today. Yeah, you got a question?
Yeah, no.
Okay, I should carry on. Two conversions. There's a halachic conversion, known as a legal conversion, and there's a non-halachic conversion. Now, a non-halachic conversion is far, far, far more attractive than a halachic conversion, okay? If I was looking to marry a Jewish girl and I had the option of a non-halachic conversion, I would almost certainly go for it if you actually look at it on paper, okay? Because if she'd marry me with that, then why not? Okay, what does a non-halachic conversion and a halachic conversion give you? What's the difference? Okay, it's like this. A non-halachic conversion, let's say a synagogue, Jerry's synagogue opens up down the road and they're offering conversion for anyone who walks in the door and pays £150. Okay, so they issue a very nice certificate, you turn up on Tuesday, you give the £150, then you're considered Jewish. What does that piece of paper mean? Should we talk about that? That means that community, for that time, consider you Jewish. That's what that means. That is a non-halachic conversion, okay? Which means that this particular temple, Jerry's temple, will consider you Jewish. They will give you all rights that they would give any other born Jew in that temple. And you are Jewish as far as they are concerned. That's what that non-halachic conversion is worth. That doesn't mean if you go to Joe's temple, that it'll work in Joe's temple. Because Joe hates Joe. They hate Joe's guts. They went back to school with each other and they never spoke to each other. They bullied each other in school. And Joe and Jerry both set up Jewish temples. Jerry says, I've converted this bloke, right, for 150 quid, and this is the piece of paper saying I've converted. When he goes to the other guy's temple, they go, oh, we don't like them. No, we don't like that. That's because we don't have another 150 quid. We'll consider you Jewish. And that's it. And he goes around all the people, 150 quid. This is ridiculous. How many 150 quid do I have to do? So he goes around, and now he's got 15 pieces of paper for 15 different temples, but each temple only takes their piece of paper. Okay, so each of those pieces of paper works for the issuing body that issued that particular conversion. That is a non-halachic conversion.
Surely it doesn't matter what people in the shul or that shul think. Doesn't it really matter whether it works in Shemayim?
Exactly.
Okay.
That's the difference between a halachic conversion.
Let's not talk. That's very spiritual and ultra frum of you to say that. Oh, it only matters spiritually. Let's talk right here down on the ground. Let's say we don't know what's going on spiritually. Yes, of course, there's a spiritual change that goes on which we haven't yet discussed. And we're going to discuss it in depth. But I'm talking right here, brass tacks, whether you're Jewish. As Rabbi, I think it was Rabbi Losky that he gave a public shiur, and he said, really deep down, you're as Jewish as you feel. That bottom down is to a certain extent, you're as Jewish as you feel. And I said from Deuteronomy 10, if anyone remembers Deuteronomy 10 and 12, that really, who's really considered Jewish? Very few people can live up to the hallowed level of what it really means to be a Jew. Can you really say Jew? In the morning we say, thank you for not making me Gentile. We don't say, thank you for making me a Jew, because who can say, can you really say you're Jewish? Am I really Jewish? Have I served God with all my heart, with all my soul, and with all my resources? Have you really done that? No, maybe like for half a second, like once on a Thursday a few years ago. Well, then you were Jewish at that moment. But am I Jewish now? No, I'm ascribing to that. I can't say I'm truly Jewish. I mean, I'm ethnically Jewish, born to Jewish people, whatever that means, right? But am I really Jewish? It depends how you define that. You're as Jewish as you feel. So this guy feels Jewish because this community welcoming in and say, hi, you're one of our club, you're Jewish, we're a club, and we accept you. So that's Jewish according to them, right? Ah, a halachic conversion means you enter the people of Israel. That's a different deal entirely. You are now considered absolutely grafted to the root of Abraham. According to everyone, you can go anywhere, you're a Jew. That's it. Whether Joey thinks you're Jewish or whether Joey thinks it's irrelevant now, because you're Jewish. Okay? Everyone would accept that. You could go with that piece of paper and everyone says, yes, according to classical Jewish law, you've converted in a way which deems you Jewish with all rights and privilege like anyone else. Now you're in. Right? Now that doesn't mean it's bound by time or community. Joey's community hits financial trouble and folds. Joey's community hits financial trouble. So what happens to that piece of paper they paid 150 quid for? Now he goes to Barry's new community. Barry's starting up a new temple. We also offer conversion. I've got Joey's and Barry's. I hate that. That's Joey and Barry. Where am I, Joey and Barry? You're after another 150 quid. This thing's a good chef. What are you doing? You take 150 quid? Oh, you're learning. It's Jewish. Right. So it's working. So maybe you should convert properly. We're starting to get some friends over there. So it's like, oh, we're doing 150 quid a pop. So there's this mission. Where do you think that particular community folds away? So does all of their impetus and authority over any documentation. But if all synagogues disappeared, I'm still Jewish. It's not based upon some kind of edifice. I'm Jewish because now I'm Jewish. Because I converted through a halachic conversion. That's it. And I can't undo it. It's a spiritual change. It's a total legal change. It's not bound by a particular community at a particular time in a particular place. It's a global concept of changing your national identity. Is that clear? And that's why halachic conversion, non-halachic conversion, profoundly different. But a non-halachic conversion has to be far harder because we expect much more commitment. You can't commit, then you're not a Ben Avraham or Ben or Bas Sara. You've got to actually ascribe to the philosophy of Abraham.
It's very simple though, when you've got someone who can get into heaven by just keeping this
seven nachalim.
Why would you just?
That's why Jews don't go around proselytizing. That's right.
When you're condemning this guy to.
That's absolutely correct. If a Gentile doesn't keep the Sabbath, right? So they think that's great. Okay, so that's great. If a Gentile converts and then doesn't keep the Sabbath, they're punishable for not keeping the Sabbath. Dude, give us a hass and just don't convert. that's easier, right? That's easier. Others say no. They're still open to more rewards. Because they have the ability to come back to the Sabbath and say, okay, left to right, you can argue left to right. But that's why we don't go around a street corner saying, join it, because it's hard work. It's hard work. That pork's yummy. Eat it. I go here because I'm on a different prescription. But why? Now, if you want to say you want to take that on, then you really have to. You have to show the effort, right? That's the sort of halachic and non-halachic conversion.
So
James,
I've heard from a very reliable rabbi that...
I love that. This is this is what I'm hearing. I'm about to say something which you're not going to like, but I've heard from extremely reliable rabbis that.
It says in the Torah that a Jew who doesn't keep the Sabbath, they're temporarily cutting themselves out of the Jewish nation because it's an eternal covenant between the Jews and Hashem.
No, that's not true.
So what's
it? Not so. I don't know. You'd have to, if you want to bring from authoritative rabbis. Really, the best thing to do is bring psukim. It's really the best thing to do versus yourself. Next time you hear someone say that, say, "I'd like to see where that says inside." Always ask that. That's what I try to source things. In the back of everything, there's notes here, sourcing everything. Everything must be sourced. An individual, one of the covenants, one of the seven covenants, in fact, for the Shabbat 250 talk that I talked to here at the Whitefield community, I talked about the seven covenants mentioned in Torah, salt, the rainbow, the Sabbath, the covenant between the parts, bris milah. They all involve a certain profound cut, a cut of philosophy, a cut of time, etc. Sabbath is the covenant of time, okay? So if an individual doesn't keep the Sabbath, they're a Jew in bad standing. That doesn't mean they're out of the group.
They have the chance to come back into the group by keeping the Shabbos the next following week.
That's true.
Then temporarily...
Yes. To a certain extent, a Jew that openly flagrates the Sabbath, knowing what the Sabbath represents, has the status legally as a non-Jew.
Yes.
However, it's really not the same.
It's like
now, let me just explain why it's not the same. let me explain why it's not the same. If you really, now, true, if an individual, now most people do not know what the Sabbath really is. They don't know the laws, they don't really up with it all. And if they break the Sabbath, they don't really know what they're doing. We're talking an individual who absolutely has mastery over the laws and knows what the Sabbath is, which is, we're talking like a handful of people, okay? Who really know what they're doing. And they openly forget Sabbath, heaven forbid. That person now has the status of a Gentile, where if they turn on an oven, etc., and they cook food, that is considered as if a non-Jew turned on the oven, and there's a whole thing of paspalter, pasakum, etc., like that, etc., which are. However, let's say that Jew says, you know, next Sabbath I'm going to keep it.
Yes.
What do they have to do to go through?
All they have to do is accept it. If they've accepted, they're going to keep the next Sabbath, then they're back in the club.
Don't they have to go to a Beis Din and say, I'd like to join the Jewish people. Please, could you redo my bris milah? And can I go and have
about,
a mikveh?
No, we're talking
about non-Jews. Maybe you... hold on, what am I saying here? If you're considered out the club, if you don't keep the Sabbath, do you have to convert again?
No.
Why not?
No, I'm saying, but it's the key, it's temporarily cutting out.
But what's it, so what does that really mean? The deal is like this. Yes, in certain ways, we live for keeping the Sabbath. And therefore, if you don't do that, you're missing a key element. But it isn't so bad that you sever yourself from your root.
What if you die?
Hold on, whoa. Let's just answer a question. Enjoy the answer, chew it over, swallow it, and then think about that before, yeah? If an individual doesn't keep the Sabbath, it doesn't mean they've definitely done something which they're missing a tremendous opportunity to do, but it doesn't mean they now have to convert to come back. One thing I will say parenthetically, for individuals that were not close to Judaism and practiced other religions, but they were born Jews of a Jewish, halachically Jewish mother, if they want to come back to regular Judaism, they're still counseled to go to mikveh. No, not with a brocha, not in front of people who are going to witness it, but it's the same concept that they've left the mindset of Judaism. They've started worshipping in churches or temples and things like that. They should go to mikveh. That's not binding. If they don't do it, they of course still are bound to have to keep the Sabbath once they decide they want to be Jewish, right? Okay, want to live a Jewish lifestyle. But they don't have to go through the conversion process. I can't take too much time out of that. I've only got a few minutes.
For example, for a kosher minyan, it has to have at least a minimum of 10 men who keep Sabbath. If there's 9 men,
we don't know.
If there's 9 men and there's one,
it's very rare to know who isn't keeping. And in different kahillas, in different communities, there's those that keep the Sabbath and those that don't. There's different levels of what keeping the Sabbath means to people.
Just
so okay, so there's actual guidelines of what that means. And in different kahillas, there are different levels. But today, if there are 10 Orthodox Jews that come together and they say they keep the Sabbath, we hold that it's a minyan. We don't sit them down and say, right, give me from Chayresh to Hotzah, Baal Peh, with all the Durabonons. And tell me what's Oseh Shtei Botanirin, the difference with the Rambam, who says it's actually making nets rather than making two heddles. Okay? Not everyone knows about the concept of how to utilize a loom. But if you really want to keep the Sabbath, you have to know all the laws of weaving. You have to know those in and out, because that has practical ramifications. It's best to keep it the mitzvahs, okay? Okay. Phew, that was an interesting side point. Okay, I'm back. So where do we get to, guys? Point over point five, 141, is that correct? Oh, this is really important. Are we all together? Are we good? It is also necessary to realize that each individual tree is also divided very much as the descendants of Adam are divided into root, tree, and branches. So too, each tree is divided. That means in each tree, there are primary branches, like a trunk, that can be distinguished into an individual tree. That's a larch, that's a conifer, that's a maple, you know, that's... These branches are then differentiated themselves to yield that particular member of their group. Abraham's tree consisted of 600,000 main branches. Now, the Torah reports there were 603,550 men between the ages of 60 that stood at Mount Sinai. We explained last time that each of them was probably married. I'm guessing that. So that's plus one over 603,550. That's times two. And we know that they all left Chemoshim armed. They all adopted 5 children. If you don't take into account that they had any children themselves, just those 603,550 men becomes a whopping 4,224,000 individuals. And that's just the men between the age of 20 and 60, their wives, and the 5 adopted children, not saying they've got any children themselves. So there were at least 4.25 million Jews standing at Mount Sinai, and that's not including or the error of the case to join them, which we say there was more of. Yeah. Are you okay? Don't worry. It's just a person with a door, etc. Okay. It's just a door, but it shows that you're really concentrating, and I like that. That's really good. It means you're really focused. I like that. Okay. So you've got a whopping 4.25 million people standing at that branch, 600,000 core souls. These were individuals who left Egypt, and it was to them that the Torah was given and the land of Israel divided. Okay, that's sourced at point 55, where you can talk about how many people were there. Every Jew subsequently born is now considered to be an element and descendant of those prime branches. Like a tree starts branching out branches and has little branchlets, then obviously those branches are connected to the tree. Okay, that's how it works, right? Okay. Now, it was to those 600,000 original Jews that the Torah was given. Okay, the door might slam again. Because it's slightly open. I just want to give you a heads up. Okay, there we go. Liz organized it. It was to these 600,000 original Jews that the Torah was given. When this occurred, the tree was said to have attained maturity, i.e. it can now give forth fruit. At that time, God also gave the 70 nations, I'm adding in the word 70 here so you understand it's the other nations, a last chance. This is the end of the 452-year second chance. In his mercy, he had suspended their final judgment from the generation of dispersion, the Tower of Babel, in 1996, until the time the Torah was given in 2448, which is the English year 1313 BCE, with the revelation at Sinai. He then offered the Torah to every nation, giving them the opportunity to accept it. If any nation would have then accepted the Torah, it would have elevated itself from its tree type, from its lower state as well. As it was, as it turned out, none of them desired the Torah, and their judgment was therefore sealed completely. The gate is shut. The gate was permanently closed at that point, never again to be opened, I would add in the words, their choice. They were offered, they were given absolute free volition, very clear instruction as to what it involved, and they said no. Now, that doesn't mean all avenues are closed. It still remained possible, however, for any underlying individual to convert to Judaism, just not nationally. In this manner, he or she could still include themselves in Abraham's tree, as it were, that root of lifestyle type and their spiritual path in life, of their own free will. But not on a national, en masse basis. Yeah? Is that clear to everyone? Laser.
The individuals from the other nations not joining the mass revelation, not joining the mass conversion.
No, no, because we happened afterwards. They were given their chance prior to us. So they couldn't join us because they'd already said no. So that's that. So time had passed. So they were given that opportunity. The party's over. And now another party is beginning. They can't join a second party. Yeah? So the question for the tape was, and it's like playing Jeopardy. There was the answer. Now what was my question? What is the capital of Poland? The question was, could those nations who were going to be offered the Torah join the Jewish nation? The answer is no, they'd already said no prior to us. We were chosen by default. We said yes later.
So what's the source behind that where the Torah joined on masse?
This right here, the fact that there was modern Torah. God offered the Torah en masse. He'd never offered anything en masse prior to that. Now that he has closed the gate, you can't have an en masse, because where are they going to en masse? Let's say if every single Nigerian on earth said, I want to be Jewish, we'd have to take it one by one. Why not? Because because God isn't offering it. We can't offer the Torah like that. It's not asked to offer. God said,
Yitro, I mean, did he come with?
Yes, what you mean, Jethro, Yisroi, it was the father-in-law of Moses, the father of Zipporah. Okay? What happened with Yisroi? Some say he did convert. Some say he didn't. All agree that he definitely took his leave and went. Moses said, stay with us, and you're going to join us and get a chalik of the land of Israel. Right? And he said, no, I want to leave. and I want to teach my people the way of Tyre.
But they were still present in Shafitim somewhere.
Now, we say the people themselves that say that they are ascribing to Jethro are the Druze, D-R-U-Z-E. They hold that Jethro is their saint and that he is the one that taught them a way of life. The Druze, okay? There's quite a strong and large population of Druze today in the modern state of Israel, okay? So those are the people that hold that they're descended from Jethro, and that Jethro, interesting, it's the women that give over the entire religion to their, and their religion's being lost. They've gone to the Jews to actually codify their religion, much in the same way that we have a Shulchan Aruch, that they also have a Shulchan Aruch of sorts, as it were. That's the Druze. He himself didn't stay with the people of Israel to walk in the land with the time of Joshua. Okay. That's right. Okay. Yeah, okay. Everyone comfortable so far? Adrian.
Where were Moshe's children?
Moshe, Eliezer, and Manasseh. Well, what about them?
Where were they?
Gershon, Manasseh. They were there. They were there. They went into Eretz Israel.
Were they at the Revelation?
Were they at? Yes. No. They came later. Yes. They came later with Yisroi. They came later with Yisroi. They converted separately. They came later with Yisroi. Yisroi was the only arrow ever to penetrate the Anei HaKavod, the clouds of glory, because all missiles and projectiles were magically absorbed by the clouds of glory that God protected us with, except for one arrow shot by Yisroel with a note on, saying, come and meet your father-in-law. And if you don't want to come and meet him, come and meet your wife, who's with me. And if you don't want to meet her, come and meet your kids. Right? I.e., I can't get in through the clouds. Moses came out. When Moses came out, Aaron said, Moses, where are you going? He goes, I'm going that way. So Aaron said, okay. And when he went, Joshua, of course, Joshua Ben-Nun, when he said, Moses, Aaron, and Joshua were going, the entire cloud of Israel just followed them. So then all Israel greeted Yisroi. Okay? All Israel greeted Yisroi. That's where they were at that time. He divorced Zipporah in order to go and be the Messiah at that time in Egypt. He didn't know whether or not he was coming back. So he gave her a bill of divorce prior to going down, not knowing what his fate would be. Which is the right and responsible thing to do, okay? Because just like if one individual is going to war, often soldiers will divorce their wives so that if they get lost or captured, no one knows what happens to them, that their wives shouldn't just wait around.
So why would Miriam get leprosy?
Later, Zipporah came in, she joined the camp with you, so that was much later.
But they remarried.
They remarried. Miriam and Zipporah were outside the camp at that particular time. There's a reason they were outside the camp together. And they heard about Eldad and Medad. And she says, wow, I really feel sorry for their wives. And Miriam said, why would you feel sorry for their wives? Because now that they become prophets, I'm sure that they're going to separate from their wives, just like Moshe separated from me. And Miriam was like, what? She was like, well, Moses doesn't live with me anymore, like, because he's like a prophet, right? She's like, well, I'm a prophetess too, and I live with my husband completely normally. And that's when the whole thing kicked up about Moses and his shin. And she said, quote unquote, Loshon Hara, in the best way possible, in the most meaningful way possible, against her brother Moshe, saying that he's basically being overly frum, okay? And we don't do that. And we live normally, thank you very much. We're all prophets here, thank you very much. And she's the top female prophet at the time, by the way, Miriam. And she was living with her husband. So she said, you know, and then God stepped in and said, it's different for him. He is a quintessentially different prophet, which is why we have an entire chapter dealing with that one incident at the end of section 3 where we talk about prophecy. He was not a regular prophet. He's not treated like a regular prophet. He had to separate from his wife because in his particular case, God would call upon him ad hoc. And he had to be in a constant state of purity all the time because normal prophets have to enter a kind of a meditative trance to get anywhere near that level of consciousness. Moses was in and out of that all the time.
But she was still his wife.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. Mm. But if you marry a man of that kind of ilk, it comes with a sacrifice.
Mm.
And she paid that sacrifice, which means she gets a reward for that. But that's a one-off. No one ever arose before him like that. Mm. No one ever will be as great a prophet as Moses again. Okay? So you don't have to worry whoever, you know, marries.
No, I'm not worried.
However great, even if he becomes the next greatest prophet after, who was the next greatest prophet after Moses?
Rambam.
Who?
Yes.
Did you say the Rambam? Rambam wasn't a prophet.
Yeheskel,
no.
Zachariah.
Zachariah, no, he's one of the Treasa.
Daniel.
Who had the next clearest prophet after Moses? No.
Oh,
Who said that? What did you say?
Yeah, sure.
No.
Isaiah.
I gave it away. It was Isaiah. Isaiah was the next greatest prophet after Moses in his clarity and his voluminous production. Unbelievable.
What made God pick him?
But, section. Yes. We're going to talk about how Isaiah's a different one. Isaiah's the top of the creme de la creme of prophets. Moses wasn't almost a prophet. He was the prophecy itself. We'll discuss that. He was elevated to an angelic class being. We'll talk about why that was necessary. Okay, section three, hold hard. That's my most fun section. Section two is the hardest. That's now. Section three is the most fun. You've got to trust me on this one, guys. Okay, we've got a few more minutes left. Where do we get to? Oh, I just want to finish this point. Get to there. We got to there. Oh, so point six, right? Oh, look at this. This thing ends at point nine. Okay, I want to just try point six. Can we just do point six? Then we're going to call it a night at point six, okay? Everyone, straps on. Last minute, point six. And then we're going to go home. Hey! And there'll be tea at home if you make it. It's not offered by the Whitefield Hebrew congregation, though. The decree, however, was not that other nations should be destroyed. Chos v'shalom. They totally needed, and they have to repatriate themselves in their own manner, doing the seven Noahide laws. Have you ever heard this concept, the cornumella? This ridge in the mouth, which is tapped by an angel at birth, which makes you forget your Tyra. Well, I've got news for you. Gentiles have that too, right?
Yeah.
So why do they? Why have they got that?
They're all born Jewish.
Oh, for goodness sake, no.
No,
every Jewish should be part of the Tyra. That's it, Loretta, they forgot their Tyra. They forgot their Tyra. There's Tyra for the Gentiles, they forgot their Tyra too. So they can remember it. We forgot our Tyra, they forgot their Tyra. They're not going to be destroyed. It was only men that they would have to remain on that lower level that we discussed. But they said, no, I don't want to be as central a role and justified in creation's rectification because, frankly, I don't want to take on the lifestyle change. Fair's fair. This lower state would never have been meant for man if Adam had not sinned because Adam's whole job was to rectify creation. He was the ultimate human being. He's what humanity was meant to be. It only came to being for the whole Jew-Gentile divide. Look at this black and white here. I've been saying this for weeks. Finally vindicated with some ink and paper. It only came into being in the first place as the result of his sin. It's only because he mucked up that you get Jews and Gentiles. There wouldn't have been Jews and Gentiles had Adam have done his job. Is everyone okay with that? I mean, that makes sense, right? Section one. Does then listen back to the second recording. These nations still have the. I want to tell it. I lazy to ask the questions, but your good questions. I understand it for an hour and a half. But I see this tea at home. Remember, these nations still have the human aspect, blemished though it may be, and God desired that they should at least listen. Now that they've turned around and said no to the Tyra. God says, listen, okay, so there's a Tyra. But you know what? I still want to give you a Tyra. And that's seven Noahide laws. I want you to work as best as you can with what you've got and rectify as much as you can with what you've got. Even though you said no to me for the bumper edition, I'm not letting you off the hook with what you've got to do. You've got to do what you've got to do. These nations still have the human aspect, better those may be, because they said no. But God desires they should at least have their counterpart towards actually appropriate for mankind. Let them also do their bit to fix up what's going on with other Mauritian. He therefore granted them a full neshama, somewhat like that of a Jew. They have free will. Remember, the neshama is the free will component which draws you after what God wants to do. What is the rock? People have been here in previous terms. What is the job of a neshama? To perfect, stroke, purify the body. What is the job of a body?
To be purified by the soul.
How does a neshama purify the body?
Through
mitzvah. Through getting the body to do mitzvah, which is why all mitzvahs have physical components. How does the body get purified? By subjecting itself to the doctrines of the neshama, not its basal lusts. Woo! Okay, they were there. That was great, guys.
Yeah.
They were likewise. Yeah! They were likewise given commandments through which they could attain both material and spiritual advantages appropriate to their nature. And these are, as Loretta quite rightly pointed out, the seven universal Torah mitzvahs for them, which are given to the children of Noach. All this had to be arranged from the beginning of creation, prepared for the contingency. Oh, the
really sorry to interrupt.
We've got to go.
No, you haven't got to go at all. I just want to ask a question. A gentleman outside has lost a jacket with his bus pass and his house keys. Would anybody who might have been upstairs could have taken it or seen it? I'm really sorry to interrupt, just in case someone...
If anyone has got this man's gentleman jacket or bus pass... Nobody has it, it seems.
There's a grey thing here. What's that?
Is there anything just in case it's... That's grey.
Okay, you see, we could do the mitzvahs of a Shabbos Aveda right there. We've just given back lost property. Okay, all this had been arranged from the beginning of creation, prepared for the contingency that man would sin. God had to open the door that it could be possible for him to fail, otherwise it wouldn't be a real free choice. In this respect, it is like any other harmful thing in punishment, which were also created conditionally as a...
Sorry, I got very excited, but it's not.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, basically the point is that they were given this opportunity to fix up what they've got to fix up because Adam did his original sin. That doesn't mean the Gentiles are out the way because they've said no to the Torah. For all they've done is said no to the additional bits. But they've still... Nobody can usurp and undo the general human laws which God has given to man, which are the seven Noahide laws, in order to be able to fix up their elements of creation. Neither is the last question of the night.
And it's still a challenge for them because the whole reason they rejected...
100% free will!
The whole reason they rejected was because they didn't agree with one of the... They found one of the struggles...
Right, that's a... There's free will for Jews, free will for Gentiles. Jews have their role, Gentiles have their role. We're all working to rectify creation. Gentiles, because they have said no, have less opportunity to rectify creation now, because they've said we don't want in. Okay, so you're working on the gross seven, which everyone's working on. Jews, because we said yes, we're signing up to this particular change of, then we're more central in our role, but that also means we have a wider responsibility. People, it has been absolutely awesome to see you back here. It's really, really wonderful. Again, I'm available for email questions and things like that. And of course, there's download links of everything. If you've got your name signed up, a few days you'll get the downloads of everything. You can catch up. It's all topic ordered. It's wonderful to see you. Thank you so much. Have a fantastic week.
Yeah. Okay.
So,